Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Some of you may know that I grew up in a family business run by my dad, a grocery store, but it had a butcher shop. It was known far and wide on the Southwest side, and I know that quality means something, and that's why we drive 2 hours from Northwest Indiana all the way to the Northwest side of the city of Chicago to Joseph's Finest Meats at 7101 West Addison Street. Before you go there, you got to be prepared, so I've got a list for you. Do you have a pen? Italian sausage, hot. Italian sausage, mild. Get pork chops, but order them thick. And of course, get some beef too, like bone-in ribeye steaks. Nothing like it. And if you don't know exactly what to get or how to cook it, ask Ben or Sal and tell them John Cass sent you. And I'd like to tip my hat to Joseph, the patriarch, the owner, the founder who built this store for his family with his two sons, Ben and Sal. In his mid-90s, he had serious heart surgery and he made a triumphant return. He loves his place and I do too. And so does anyone who shops there. It's like family. They care about the details. They care about you. Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street, Chicago. A family tradition since 1977, and a proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way podcast. You remember the horrific deaths at E2 nightclub in Chicago? Security guards were charging people to get into the place and locking the doors because they didn't want people to sneak in the other side and because they didn't want to lose their money. They were making money. Everyone was making money. Let me tell you about E2. It was a very hot, popular nightclub for young people in the South Loop. In February of that year, there was a crowd in there, and a fight breaks out. People were afraid that there was fire. There was pepper spray in the air. They panicked and began to stampede, but they couldn't get out because the security guards had locked the doors, and so they were trampled to death. The next day, I drove down to work because I worked at the Tribune at the paper, and I was driving by the nightclub and thinking of the devastation and all those kids, 20 or maybe more of them, 25, 30, who were trapped in the stairwell and trampled to death by frightened other kids who thought that there was a fire and there wasn't. And who's there? I could see his blue dress coat and his hands in his pocket. And he's just standing there posing, standing in front of the nightclub posing, like I'm thinking of how sad I am that those people died. I mean, it was a pose, but I knew him. His name was Barack Obama. Do you remember him? And at that time, news reporters from the various news stations were on the other side of the street, kept away by cops. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, Barack." He's like, "Hey, John. Hey, Brother Cass." He used to call me Brother Cass. I hated that. I said, "You know, those cameras that are across the street, they don't know who you are, but they know me." Because then I was, you know, Mr. Big Shot, page two guy at the Tribune. And I could see him screaming now, maybe Stevie Tasker or one of the other guys, cameramen, "Why do you let Cass be over there? We have to get over there." You know, they were getting edgy. And I said, "You know, in a few seconds, they're going to be here, Barack, and they're going to ask you, what are you doing here?" And he says, "Well, I knew some of the investors in this nightclub." Barack knew the owners, and he didn't want to be any part of a story about E2. And the media would help him because they love Barack Obama. And I guess I helped him too, because I told him, "You stand here, keep standing here like a guy who's sad." He was posing, and that's what really bothered me, the pose. You know, like, "Oh, I'm sad. Like, look at me, I'm sad. Those kids are dead, but you're pretending to be sad." And he ran when I told him that they were going to come and ask him questions, and he didn't want to answer them. There was no Jim Comey and Clapper and CIA director to stand there and lie for him. There was no David Axelrod. There's just a newspaper man like me and a bunch of weekend camera crews coming over, and he didn't want any part of it, so he ran. That was Barack Obama. A year, maybe a year later, he ran for president and all of a sudden was transformed from the guy who dealt with people like E2 and Tony Resco as his bagman, transformed into a spiritual creature like Mr. Tumnus from the Narnia books, who would have tea and cake with the journalists, and they would love him, and they would fall asleep in his lap, and he would tuck them in and put them to bed. That was Mr. Tumnus, the kind Mr. Tumnus. And that's how Obama played it. And we're going to talk today with Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, about media trust, about a big lecture I'm going to be giving, and about Nicolas Maduro and Governor Tim Walz, also known as Tampon Tim, who I guess has decided not to run for governor because of the $9 billion worth of fraud that's in Minnesota. Jeff Carlin is here, my friend, executive producer, WGN Radio. And I'm John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, where for only $50 a year, you get my website delivered to your home in your email, allowing you to pour yourself a good cup of Midwestern common sense. And where are you as we think about the Democrats freaking out with Walz and the fraud and pretending that they're not involved in it, and the collapse of Maduro and the soon-to-be collapsing Cuba and Colombia? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall-style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
So as promised, our guest, Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, our friend and the professor, America's professor, that everyone wished they had when they were in college. I know I do. Charles, the world's going to hell. The Democrats are losing their minds. What is going on? Let's start with, what do we want to start with?
We want to start with Venezuela.
There you go. So when do we jump over and take Cuba?
If you're in Cuba, let's talk about Cuba for just a second. Cuba was getting all of its oil from Venezuela at a discount. And what were they providing Venezuela? They were providing Maduro with all the bodyguards around him. Those did a great job, didn't they? So I would say now Cuba is not going to have any oil from Venezuela, and their main backer, who has been Russia, is pretty preoccupied, I'd say, with a war of its own. So you've got to be wondering right now about the future of the communist regime in Cuba.
What are they just going to ask Iran to come over and help out like they did all those times before? Like when Maduro was feeling lonely, the supreme leader might send somebody over, a mullah of some kind?
Exactly. by the way, the number two person there seems to have, who the Americans right now have kind of left in charge, I don't think for very long, because mm-hmm. she seems to be in the pocket of the Iranians. Her main thing after the Americans took over was how it was all the Jews' fault.
It's always the Jews' fault. You know that.
Really? Really? No, I blame the Greeks, you know, John. I don't know.
Because they're the first irritant. The seed in the shoe, you know? But it's always this case with the left, you know, blaming the Jews, blaming others.
Yeah.
I know two things to be true. One is that subscribers to John Cass News have access to a good cup of common sense. And to go with that cup of common sense is the perfect cup of coffee. Ribby Coffee. It's never bitter, air roasted, and customized. It's the best coffee around. Ribbycoffee.com. That's KRIBICoffee.com. If you're near Forest Park or Oak Park, be sure to stop by one of the Cribby cafes where you can order ahead and earn points on the easy to use Cribby Coffee app. Yeah, there's an app. The Cribby Coffee app makes it easy to get your favorite air roasted coffee faster than ever. Earn points on every purchase toward free drinks and freshly roasted coffee. Customize your order, pay with Google Pay or Apple Pay, and skip a line. Your daily coffee just got a whole lot smoother. Of course, if you can't make it to the cafe, you can always order your favorite air-roasted coffee sent directly to your door. My favorite is the Mount Oku from Cameroon. You pick the beans, you customize the roast and the grind, and they send it right to your door. Want Cribby Roast delivered on your schedule? Subscribe to save 15% on your first order and 10% on every refill. Did I mention they offer K-Cups too? Ribby Coffee. RibbyCoffee.com. That's KRIBICoffee.com. Proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way podcast. Cheers.
Let's talk about Venezuela just a second. One of the things that was that's so interesting about the way that Trump had gone in other occasions has been, it's been wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. It's been very quick. And then he's out. He did that in the bombing of Iran. He did it when he got Qasem Soleimani and so forth. This time in Venezuela, he recognizes you can't just take out one leader. And he said, we'll have boots on the ground. This is very uncertain. And it's I think the key there will be whether or not the military is willing to stay and take on the Americans, and conversely, whether the Americans are willing to stay and take on the military, because otherwise you just got a big mess. But Venezuela, this is the point that people shouldn't overlook. Venezuela has a lot more oil than Saudi Arabia, and it's close to America. The problem, there are two problems with that oil. One is that it's very heavy oil, which is hard to refine. You can do it, but you have to set up your refineries to do it. And since we haven't been refining that oil much, that will have to be done. But the other thing is that with Hugo Chavez and then Maduro, all of the infrastructure ran down and very little oil was being pumped. So it all has to be rebuilt. That won't happen immediately. But when it does, it'll be a huge boon to the world economy.
And to the people of Venezuela. Yeah.
And they don't refine it themselves either. I mean, that's a big problem. They don't have that infrastructure even close. So it's got to go out crude.
It goes to Houston. It goes to Houston. Yes.
We will provide, Jeff. Don't worry. We will provide. America will provide.
Well, I think we should bring in Mandami to run the country. They're already used to socialism, and it would relieve New York of the burden.
But they've already eaten all the zoo animals,
oh,
I think.
God. Oh, God. How do people not learn from these experiences?
I'm not joking. Those of you who are listening, you might think it's a joke.
Yeah.
Charles and Jeff, no, it's not a joke. When Chavez turned this country to socialism and Maduro took over, there was so much instability and loss of economic infrastructure, the people started eating the zoo animal for food. They had no food.
Oh, God. I mean,
and this really is the place where the CTU likes to spend their holidays.
Oh, so. Yes. Well, what about that, Jeff?
I'd forgotten about that. Jeff. I'd forgotten.
I don't think they're going this way.
But didn't they put out CTU put out a statement in solidarity with Maduro. They're sort of like the idiot Democrats. I saw Tim Kaine on national television over the weekend bemoaning Maduro's fall. Like, how stupid do you have to be?
Really? Right. When you end up, how do they get there? They start off with, what do I hate about Trump today?
Yeah,
right.
It's reflex.
And then Trump often uses that then to put them in a position where they back the worst kinds of
people,
policies, and people.
Right.
I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, they did. While we talk, I'm going to search this because I think CTU put out a statement on Maduro.
Really?
Well, I mean, they've whether they did or not. I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't be surprised if they did, but it's no prize to praise him in the past, saying he's even better than Rahm Emanuel as far as a leader is concerned. So, what more do you need? I mean, that was 2019, I think it was, somewhere around there. They literally went to Venezuela and said, "Hey, we're going to go embrace this socialist regime and bring back all the good things they're doing for their people."
Good Lord!
So I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
All this stuff, and we haven't even gotten the other stuff now, all this is encouraging me to sit back in a leather chair in a men's club and order a scotch and soda from the waiter and then light up a fine Maduro cigar. Because I can't tell you, this is a celebratory mood. I'm sure I'll be upset at the midterms, but right now I'm quite happy.
Well, yes, I think, but all of us who celebrated the fall of Saddam and so forth have to remember that the next part is also a very hard part, and you have to be able to set up a government in that's stable enough in Venezuela. And the fact, I think that Trump's initial idea not to install the woman who had actually been elected was an attempt to avoid this entanglement where the U.S. is backing but the question is whether the number two person who is publicly saying one thing, whether behind the scenes she has enough power to actually oust the drug lords and the military people. If she doesn't, then who will do it? The U.S. And that then, you know, Pottery Barn rules, you break it, you own it.
One thing that they should all understand in Venezuela is that Donald Trump is not Joe Biden. Okay. And if they break bad on the people of Venezuela, he'll just take them out.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, we know a couple of things. That there's been reporting out that the U.S. intelligence has someone, if not many people, well inside Venezuela and inside of Maduro's regime. They had all his information. They had mock-ups of his place. And it showed, right? The U.S., we said, snapped our fingers, and Maduro was gone.
I just want to take time right now, Jeff, because you mentioned it, and I'm sorry for interrupting.
Okay. I know where you're going.
Blood comes before anything, and I just want to tip my hat to my younger brother, Nicholas.
Well, that's where I was going.
Go on.
With Joe, John, absolutely. I've been thinking about him all weekend.
He's the chairman of National Intelligence, and he's in charge of trying to bring all these intelligence agencies together. And he works with Tulsi Gabbard. And, you know, he was with us over the weekend, before the weekend, for the Christmas holidays. And I said, "What's going on, Nick?" Typical Nick. He's like, "I don't know, not much. Everything's okay. Everything's calm." And then he goes, "But I have to leave. I have to go. I'll be back. I'll be back in a few days. I have to go back to Washington." I'm like, "Why, Nick? You're pulling the plug there. Why go back?" And he goes, I'm just going to go just tie up some loose ends. And my hat.
Order some pizzas.
I tip my hat to him.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it is impressive what they did. The level of intelligence, the word they use is exquisite.
Yeah. All those moving parts. You had hundreds of planes in the air. You had men on the ground, men in boats, men in helicopters. The SEALs and the Delta Force went to get Maduro, and not one American life was lost.
And no equipment.
There were quite a few actually lost in Panama when we went in to get Noriega, and people don't remember that. But as I say, the immediate issue is, can we stand up a government that can actually control the country and return it? There's a good history there. It's not like Afghanistan, which was just tribes and it never had a really strong central government that ruled the country. Venezuela has a long, successful history. And
they were wealthy.
Yes.
A wealthy country.
Exactly. And they're homogenous. Right. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, not broadly, but they're very much the same culture across the board. It's not a place where you're going to find a lot of sex and things like that, except for the drug lords. I mean, that's like you said earlier, is a really interesting question. I mean, Trump's already been showing them that he's ready to take them all out. So they should be worried. And this latest action there show that we can take any leadership out we don't like. So really, I feel like we've got a strong hand there, and we've got no one on the ground. I mean, this is kind of the best case scenario for us.
Right. I think all that's true. I think a lot of the drug lords will be looking to see if they can get over to Colombia.
Yeah.
But then the people who are in Colombia running those drugs, and it's another terrorist drug state, are going to want to preserve their own monopoly. So it'll be interesting to see how all this shakes out in both Cuba and in Mexico.
And China.
China, it's so interesting because
China. And Russia.
Right. Yes. China has been trying to build up a position in Latin America. Yeah. And anybody who is not friendly with the Trump administration is going to be looking to China, but they're going to be noticing that it's very risky to be on the far side of Donald Trump. The good news for China is that, and there's not much, but the good news for China is that if oil prices really do come down in the medium term, then it's an oil importer. And that will be good news for them. Global oil prices sinking is a good news for all consuming countries. Trump also gave a warning to Iran, and Iran has to be shaking in its boots. They've been trying to rebuild their missile program and do what they can to restart the nuclear program. And I would just say that that's a bad idea. And what we don't know in Iran is whether these demonstrations will continue and whether or not the military will hold, whether there will be enough military who support the regime to suppress, or whether the military will go over to the side of the protesters.
If the protesters are seen as anti-statist and anarchists, the military will, by nature, support the mullahs.
That's right.
But I hope who's ever promoting them in the country,
right,
that they're promoted as people who
right.
care about their country rather than anarchists. Right.
Well, one interesting thing about China and all this is, as all of its allies have faced trouble, China has been nowhere to be seen.
That's very true.
It did nothing to help Iran. So that's very interesting. If you think about allying with China in order to stand up to the Trump administration, you better think again, because the Chinese are not coming in to help you, especially if they don't think they can win.
Yeah.
But what about there are other parts of Latin America that were being ceded by the Russian and Chinese intelligence. That's why I'm so excited about this, because I'm finally seeing a United States president standing up for his own hemisphere, not to offend the Syrians and all that, but I don't live in Syria. We're not from Syria. We're not from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But and even though we have Israel as our defensive ally, our people, our country is looks to our own hemisphere, and what he's doing is stupendous. What are the political reverberations of this, Charles, domestically?
They're very big, but there's a lot of ambiguity in the air about it right now, John. Here's the reason. Trump has reoriented U.S. policy toward the Western Hemisphere, and that has had a big effect on our allies in Europe.
Right.
That the North Star of American international politics for since about 1947 has been containing Russia, and Trump has moved away from that. Now, initially, the idea was that okay, we'll support it, but the Europeans have to do more to pay for it. Now, the Biden administration had pursued the traditional American policy, although, as usual with Biden, it was too little too late. But Trump has been very reluctant to support Ukraine, even with the Europeans buying all the American equipment. And that really represents a tectonic shift in American policy. We don't know how far it'll go, because it's not in America's interest for Russia to win that war. It is in America's interest to contain Russia. Right. And if the Europeans are willing to pay for that, that's a bonus. There's a legitimate question as to whether or not the U.S. should be willing to put any more money into that war. But the Ukrainians have fought fiercely. They've, in effect, forged a nation in the midst of this war. And if the Europeans are willing to step up, especially the ones in Eastern Europe that were formerly dominated by Moscow, those are the ones that are really stepping up. And finally, Germany stepped up. But it is not only not in the interest of the United States to contain Moscow, it's in the interest of the United States to have a very close working security relationship with Europe, not to let them go off on their own.
We are speaking to Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, the Peter B. Ritzma Chair, longtime writer, thinker, you might say philosopher, and author. And you can find all his stuff, or most of his stuff, at charleslipson.com. Let me give you a hint of what he's written. Greenland, Colombia, Cuba, Mexico, who will the U.S. target next? Next one. Trump's desperation is getting dangerous for Ukraine. Next one. Is Trump becoming a lame duck president? Yes. Next one. The far left is the new face of the Democratic Party, and I see Mondami, his hands up. And J.D. Vance in the Telegraph. J.D. Vance has cast a shadow over U.S. relations with Israel. My gosh, you have been very busy, man. Very busy.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. I find these issues really interesting, and, you know, I differ from some of my colleagues in that I'm not always cocksure about what the right answer is. I try to give what I think the best answer is, but I also try to say, well, here's what we don't know. Here's what could go right. Here's what could go wrong. And I hope that sense comes through in the pieces.
Well, I'm glad, and there's something I need to ask you off that.
Okay.
And that is, because of your kindness and, I guess, good offices, you have contacts at the one I think is the what we would have once called the Harvard of the Midwest, Hillsdale's College, but you wouldn't want to destroy Hillsdale with that, insult them with that comparison. They have asked me to give a lecture at their college in February on the loss of trust, the loss of trust in media. Okay, the legacy media's loss of trust. And basically, I've been apoplectic for weeks, and I can't even begin. Do you have any pointers on how do I begin to make this lecture work?
First of all, you know, the first thing to say about it is that nobody is better positioned to talk about this than you are, John. You just have a wealth of knowledge. And what let me go back to the days when I was a graduate student at Harvard and would listen to people who came in and were journalists and were talking about issues like this and what I thought they got wrong in a general way. Not is they came in and they tried to be a professor,
right?
And they tried to do here's the big overview, you know, and whereas if I came in, if I were an expert on Chicago politics, which thank goodness I'm not, and were sent into the Trib editorial to talk about it in the Trib editorial board, if I tried to talk about it like a journalist with the sort of pointillist knowledge that journalists have, they'd laugh me out of the room. I should do what I'm good at, which is here's how somebody sees it from 30,000 feet, which is what kind of I do as a professor, and that's where I can add value. So right. My sense about how to approach the lack of trust in media would be to not focus so much on, to make your lecture sound like what Charles Lipson would give a lecture on, but to make it a John Cass lecture.
I think that's why, thanks, Charles, I think that's why I'll focus on the elevation. When I saw Obama being canonized by the media, and I was on Obama. I was watching him. I was with him. I was standing on the corner at that nightclub where all the kids were killed. And I said, Barack, you better get out of here because these cameras are coming over here.
Yes.
And he took off. I should tell that story rather than. And then they didn't even want to know about Obama.
Right.
Resnick and all these.
Right. He's ancient history for them.
But they wanted to elevate him as a saint.
Right. You got it.
That was so I knew the media was dead then. Okay, I'll stick with that.
So I think here's the 30,000 foot view.
Right.
But I wouldn't start off with it. I would come back to it. It seems to me that the fact that the intellectual classes in America are now very much further left than they used to be.
Yeah.
Combined with the fact that the media itself is now fragmented thanks to technology, so that it's not that everybody in America is watching either Walter Cronkite or Huntley and Brinkley at night. It's not that all sort of people in Chicago are reading the Tribune, and if they are really interested, they get the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. It's that the people who are conservative read one thing. The people who are on the left read another. People who are in the center read another. If you're young, you don't read any of them. You look at social media in a different way. And what we know from psychology is that people tend to like they want what's called viewpoint confirmation. They don't the people who are listening to a John Cass podcast are not listening because they disagree with you. They're listening because they already agree with you on most things. That doesn't mean they agree with you on everything. But when
Charles, I don't want to discount the handful of people that do hate listening to us. I do get messages from them, and they are
Jeff, I think they mostly hate you.
they hate Jeff because he knows me.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly.
That's a great point. I do think that that the combination of this confirmation bias that we all have and the fragmentation of media and the shifting of journalists, like all the intellectual classes, to the left have produced what this lack of trust, and the lack of trust, I would say, is probably you certainly see it on the right because all the mainstream media is dominated by the left. And but what you used to not see, people distrusted the media in the past. What's different now is that you can actually see firsthand what they got wrong because other people are reporting it.
Yeah, because the left has lost control of
their monopoly. Gates.
They're not the gatekeepers
anymore. Exactly. Yeah.
I think one of the ideas I will bring up is a story. I love this story. Canicles.
I never read it. Yeah.
It was it's basically a science fiction post-apocalyptic novel. And in it, the elements are grocery lists from the time when people had stores to go to. And I thought I'm like the old man in the Ray Bradbury story in the camp of the nomads in the dystopian world. And I'll tell kids about candy bars, and there were things called old gold cigarettes and ice cream and frozen peas, and things like that until the authorities come to arrest me for sedition.
I think I would think of a few crucial anecdotes that illustrate your point. And I assume that your basic point is that the loss of trust in the media, the problem is not that people have lost trust in the media. The problem is that the loss of trust is well deserved.
Yes.
Right. That's the thing, John. That's what you and I have talked about it here forever, is that the elites, the experts, so to speak, in my lifetime have let us down left and right. I mean, especially if you're going to be talking to people who are younger than me, they've seen it too. They've seen that everybody says, "Oh, well, trust us. If you get this degree, or you go do this thing, or you go to that school, or you trust that politician, or you listen to that expert over here." And they lived through the pandemic, where it was, experts screwing up left and right, and nothing, who didn't know the answers and made stuff up. And so, I think that's where your big reveal is: we can't trust anybody anymore. And how do we get back to that? And it's by talking to people,
subscribing to John Cass.
That's the thing. That's how you rebuild. You have to have them think about how they build trust, because can't tell people how to rebuild trust. They have to feel it.
But it's a bad thing for a country when there's no trust in. It's not that when there's no trust in any of the major institutions, and it's not as if the lack of trust in the media is unique. People don't trust corporations. They don't trust them to tell the truth. They don't trust politicians. They don't trust Congress. I mean, in other words, the only organization that has more than 50% trust is the U.S. military. And my hunch is that they don't have more than 50% trust among New York Times readers.
Yes, exactly.
I think that's where it's a hot, skewer that you can kind of, or a hot coal rider you can fan, because that trust, these people are young, they're coming to you mostly, and they don't know, and they don't know what they don't know. And the idea that they have this trust to give to someone, to something, to to a politician or a family member or a, you know, a John Cass News or Charles Lipson or CNN or whatever it is.
Manipulation.
Mm-hmm. Right. And how do you teach? We got to teach them how to protect that trust and not give up that trust and then fall down a rabbit hole with that trust that is just bad and trying to misuse them. Because that's the end of the day. And I have this conversation with my father because he, you know, he watches the cable news and he trusts all the experts on there when they tell him all this stuff. And then you have to say to them, well, no, they're using your trust to sell gold and life insurance and all this other crap. They're preying on that fact that you're going to trust them.
Wait, should I buy gold though?
No.
Listen, I can't thank you guys enough for helping me because this week I'm going to run some guest columns so I can focus on this, maybe write something on Sunday. But in the meantime, another story is breaking that I have to ask you both about. And that is just this morning, the fat guy with the $2,000 shotgun or $3,000 shotgun that he didn't know how to load it in his tight dockers and his feminine jazz hands decided that maybe he's not going to rerun for reelection as governor of Minnesota. And I'm just sad about it. Charles Lipson, what about Governor Walz, we hardly knew ye.
The first thing that struck me is how both candidates on the Democratic ticket had risen so far with so little scrutiny, and how they had, and how once they got the scrutiny, it was clear that they'd risen well above their pay grade. How could anybody think that Kamala Harris, who can't string together a full sentence?
What was the line? To be before we knew what to be. What was that nonsense was coming out of her mouth?
The point about progress is to have the ability to have a vision and a belief and some faith in what can be, unburdened by what has been.
To call it pablum is to insult pablum. But the thing about, let's go back to Walt. Whenever I look at him, I think of the guy with no brain in The Wizard of Oz. I think of the people who are walking down the yellow brick road, you know, written. That, by the way, do people know that The Wizard of Oz was actually a political allegory?
Not anymore, I don't think, Charles.
Tell us.
Well, you know, Frank Baum wrote a lot of that stuff in the Fine Arts Building in Chicago.
Yeah, Oz Park here in Chicago, named in his honor, has a very cool statue.
Right. I live on the South Side, so I don't see Oz Park very much. But there's a Tin Man in Oz Park, right?
Yep.
The Yellow Brick Road was about the first great moment, maybe the second great moment of American populism. The first was Andrew Jackson. But in the 1890s, the populists were Democrats, and they were William Jennings Bryan. And they wanted easy money, and the Republicans wanted hard money, which meant gold backing. And so they were walking, walking along the yellow brick road and so forth was all these allegories to populism and gold and all of the events of the time. It's worth remembering that that populist movement led by the Democrats failed. William Jennings Bryan ran for president three times, I believe, and he lost every time. McKinley, who is a hero of Trump's, and fought the Spanish-American War, something that again should give them chills in Havana. the Republicans dominated until Franklin Roosevelt won. The only exception was Woodrow Wilson, who won two terms, and he won one of those terms because two Republicans ran against him, Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. So the fact is...
So what was the cross of gold speech? What was that cross of gold?
We will not be crucified on a cross of gold. So it was designed to meld a Christian fundamentalism with populist easy money. We don't want gold-backed currency. We want free silver was their motto, and which meant pump money into the economy. So it
kind of stupid, right? Yeah, it was kind of stupid.
Well, it leads to inflation and so forth. But yeah. A lot of these farmers, their beef was that if you were a Midwest farmer, you were out in Kansas, let's say, and you're raising grain, you had only one way to get it to market, and that was with a monopoly railroad. And then who was really making the big money besides the railroads? They thought that it was the guys in Chicago at the options exchange buying and selling this stuff. And so it was a move against big money, and you can see a lot of the same themes in both left and right wing populism today, and that's part of the transformation that Trump executed in the Republican Party. It's no longer the party of big business. The Democrats have kept running against it as if it was, but Trump has turned it into much more of a populist party. You can really see that in J.D. Vance.
I don't think that they're going to let this $9 billion and counting fraud in Minnesota that's leached into Maine, that's leached into Los Angeles. Where else is it gone? Somali population, and I'm not trying to pick on the poor Somalis who are refugees, but I mean, God, come on. The arrogance of
Ilhan Omar.
She's so arrogant that I think that she will be tied around the Democratic Party's neck as the albatross, along with Waltz and the rest. No?
I agree. The thing is, it's all for naught for the Republican. For the Republicans, if the economy doesn't give them a strong boost coming into the midterms, it's hard to win in the midterms anyway. The Democrats are without a leader and won't have
Hakeem Jeffries.
The people who lead both parties in Congress are people who work inside the chamber. They're not equipped to be public figures. Nobody looks to Mike Johnson or Senator Thune as major public figures. Their job is to herd the cats. And boy, what a tough job that is. But the problem for the Democrats is not only that they don't have a leader, their previous generation is now seen to have failed. So they've got a new generation that needs to take over. And the problem is that the new generation has taken over in deep blue cities, which are willing to elect Karen Bass in Los Angeles and Mayor 6% in Chicago and Mamdani in New York. So, and the Republicans will hang that around them. And New York is a real, you could see the mainstream media was trying their best to say, oh no, we elected moderates in New Jersey and Virginia. But the fact is New York dominates, the media, and their answer, which is a sort of straightforward socialism is, it's failed everywhere they've tried it, and it will fail here. They will need bailout money from Albany, which won't give it, and from Washington, which won't give it at all, and will use them as a poster boy.
How should the American voter assess the Democratic fear of being called a racist that allowed the fraud to perpetuate and multiply throughout Minnesota and the rest of the country?
That's really crucial, John. I'm so glad you mentioned that.
I would be a good student of yours then, I hope.
It was so clear that the first time anybody went after the fraud in Minnesota they were accused mm-hmm. of racism. And who wants to be accused of that? It's like a red wine spilled on a white carpet. You can't get that stain out. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to suffer through that. And the Somalis knew it, and they played right to it. The other huge loser in all this is the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Yeah.
I looked at their top stories for 2024 when they should have been all over this. It was the 10th story, and it was done with a kind of question mark. Was there fraud? You know, in other words, like somebody else should look it up.
You tell us.
Yeah, you tell us. Exactly. And the main story this time was broken by one guy who was an independent reporter, not the main newsroom in the main newspaper. So this is a scandal for the media, too. So when people are talking about trust in media, John, you might look to this Minnesota scandal and who reported it and who didn't.
We saw this in Chicago, and I know Jeff's thinking about rapping, but Jeff, please forgive me. We saw this in Chicago with Tony Preckwinkle and Pritzker and the Safety Act. They're taking people out of the jail, all these repeat offenders, and releasing them back onto the street, and they allowed this to happen because the social justice warriors would attack, and I'm talking about those on the staff of both newspapers, would attack anyone who dared say, like, stop this, we can't do this, because you don't want to be called a racist by your own social justice warrior in the newsroom. And that's when it collapses.
Exactly. And I think what you're seeing now is this broader culture war over this. But I think that people are in a sense voting with their feet. I mean, look at where people are moving to and look at where they're moving from.
There you go. Happy New Year, my friend.
Good to talk to you, my friend. Great to talk to you, Jeff.
Always good to have you, Charles. Happy New Year.
To you as well.
For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, the Peter B. Ritzma Chair. For Jeff Carlin, my friend and executive producer of WGN Radio. And me, John Cass, editor of John Cass News. We always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Join us again next time, won't you, on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.